Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes with you every Saturday afternoon here on News Talk 580 KMJ and online kmjnow.com. This week, we're going to hear from a West Texas farm boy. Yeah, the San Joaquin Valley does not have exclusivity on farm boys, and we found one in West Texas who still lives on the farm where he was born nearly 89 years ago. I want to thank his son for letting me know about him. His son would be Gid Atkison III. That means we're talking to Gid Atkison Jr., an Army veteran of World War II. And do I have that right? Can I call you a West Texas farm boy?
Yeah, sure.
What's it like out in West Texas this time of year?
Well, this year it is extremely dry. It's the driest year we've had since 1934. There are very few crops to look at because there hasn't been enough moisture to plant.
Well, all those farmers out here in the San Joaquin Valley can identify because they've had years like that. This year they've got a very wet year to deal with, so I hope maybe that'll come your way next year there in West Texas. You're just outside of Abernathy, Texas, not far from Lubbock and Texas Tech country, but I understand you're an Aggie. You're a Texas A&M guy.
Correct.
And is that where you were on December 7th, 1941? Were you there in College Station?
Yes, I was.
What do you remember about that day? How did you hear about the attacks on Pearl Harbor?
It was Sunday afternoon, right after noon chow, and several guys and I had gone down to the gymnasium to play a little pickup basketball. One of our friends came in and said, the Japanese had bombed Pearl Harbor.
What did that mean to you?
Well, see, that was a military school, and all of us were aspiring to get a commission in the Army.
Mm-hmm.
This intrigued us. Okay, now what's the future hold for us? We knew that it would affect us and probably affect us profoundly, but we weren't sure and nobody really knew.
Well, who could have known what you were going to go through? And over the course of this program, we're going to hear a lot about it. We're even going to hear about some recent events and a surprise that Mr. Atkison got recently. But back there in 1941, you said you had a feeling it might affect you profoundly. How long was it before you were actually in uniform and going to work for Uncle Sam?
Like I mentioned, it was a military school.
Mm-hmm.
And we continued in a speed-up program. At the time I heard about it, I was a sophomore. And we completed our sophomore year in May. 10 days later, we began our junior year. It wasn't a summer school. It was a full year's work.
Mm-hmm.
And in the first part of January, we became seniors. And shortly thereafter, the federal government called all the juniors and senior class who were physically able to active duty at one time. But the administration at A&M entered a plea with the government that if you let us have these guys for another, I think, 6 weeks, we will give them a cram course and credit for this semester's work.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what happened. And after that, the senior class was going to go to OCS. The junior class would be in boot camp. And then they had a pass to OCS, Officer Candidate School. The seniors that I was with, the class was split into three parts, three places. And I ended up at Fort Sam Houston in San Antonio, Texas. I think there was about 300 or 400 of us.
Did you feel like it was easier for you to go through that transition with all these other guys from your school, that by being together with the guys from your same class at Texas A&M, that it kind of streamlined that process for you?
I think it did.
You probably didn't feel as on your own as maybe some other recruits might have at that point.
I can tell you kind of a funny tale about when we reported in to Fort Sam Houston.
Mm-hmm.
To get our uniforms and shots and haircuts and so forth. We all reported in civilian clothes. And about noon, they told us to get out and get ready for noon chow. And there was a sergeant there lining us up to fall in. And, of course, we put on a West Point deal for him. He started us marching down the street, and we could see a mess all off to our right. But he got to the end of the street. He gave column left. and we started turning left, and he said, "No, damn it, I meant right." And then he said, "Stop." And everybody fall out and go to the mess hall. But it was buffaloed him completely. He didn't know who we were or what we were. We'd had some military training.
Yeah, you'd had all that practice at Texas A&M as an all-male military right. school at the time. And it sounds right. like you were following orders better than he was giving them.
That's right.
I'm sure there are some other colorful instances from that training time at Fort Sam Houston before you went overseas. Anything else that stands out for you?
Well, we stayed at Fort Sam Houston for, I don't know, I guess maybe 6 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
Then we went to officer candidate school. Some of us went to infantry officer candidate, some to field artillery, and I went to Fort Benning, Georgia in the infantry. The ones in artillery went to Oklahoma. I've forgotten the name of the camp there.
Fort Sill.
And yeah, that's right, Fort Sill, Oklahoma. And there were several others that went to different branches. But while we were there, we had a first sergeant who didn't particularly like college kids.
Uh-huh.
And we kind of made life miserable for that poor guy.
Now, how would you do that?
Well, he called over to the barracks one night, late one afternoon, and he was telling us about this, that, and the other, what we ought to do. And we could hear him when he clicked the button where he could hear. And he clicked that button, and somebody said, "Go to hell, Sergeant." And about 2 minutes later, boy, he skidded in the door and said, "Who said that?" And, of course, we were all innocent. Who said what? He said, "Who told me to go to hell?" And he said, "You must have the wrong barracks." And said, "That sounds like old so-and-so over in this next barracks here." And he took off over there. And we just kind of aggravated him, I think. He wasn't too well educated. Our bunks, at the end of the foot of them, was a footlocker.
Mm-hmm.
At the head of them, there was next to the wall, there was couple of shelves up above the bed, and we all got a big kick out of he made this classic statement. Said, "I don't want nothing on them there shelves, and what's there, I want it neat." And but I'm sure he was glad to see us leave.
Sounds like it. And you wouldn't be leaving there till late 1943 when you got your commission. And
we spent 17 weeks in officer candidate school and finished up in late November, and when we got our commission.
Knowing that you were going to be an infantry officer, maybe understanding what that meant, maybe not entirely understanding what that was going to mean, do you look back on that time, those 17 weeks in OCS, and see that you learned something that served you well once you were actually in combat?
That's right. We did learn quite a bit. Some things were irrelevant, we found out, when we got to OCS. But we learned quite a bit. Of course, we'd already been studying military science at A&M, but this just added to it. And gave us, in OCS we fired weapons. In OCS, I fired every weapon that the Army had, from 22 rifle on up to 105-millimeter cannon.
That runs the spectrum, that's for sure. And so you would get your commission as a second lieutenant in November of 43, and they told you to go to Yuma, Arizona, but I understand that you had somewhere more important to go before you went to Yuma.
Yes, that's when I got married.
And this year, you and Marie will celebrate your 68th wedding anniversary?
That's correct.
Wow. I think there are a lot of people that will salute you for that. They haven't even heard what you did in the service yet, but 68 years of marriage, almost 67 and a half for now, is certainly something we can tip our cap to.
Before I'll tell you the secret.
The secret.
I married a very tolerant woman.
A very tolerant woman.
Yeah, she put up with me all these years.
Now, with the tone of your voice there, it sounds like you gave her plenty to tolerate over 67 years.
Yes, I did.
And you're not done yet, are you?
Nope.
An honest man. Well, we're about that point in the show where we need to take our first commercial break. But when we come back, we're going to hear about how our guest, Ged Atkinson Jr., earned the Bronze Star, the Purple Heart. We're also going to hear in written form from a soldier who says our guest today, Gid Atkinson, saved his life in France in World War II. The best of this program is yet to come. We'll be back with more Hometown Heroes here on News Talk 580 KMJ.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. We're going to continue now with Gid Atkinson, decorated Army veteran of World War II, joining us today from his home on a farm in West Texas, the same farm where he was born nearly 89 years ago, just outside of Abernathy, Texas. Gid Atkinson, our guest. I want to thank his son, Gid Atkinson III, for letting me know about him. And a lot of you always ask me, how do I find the guys that are on this show? Well, the answer is I usually don't find them. They find me by way of their children or neighbors or somebody who knows them, and that's the case this week. So if you know someone that you think we ought to talk to here on Hometown Heroes, let us know. When we left off with Gid Atkinson, we were talking about him getting married to this lovely young lady named Marie. They're still married more than 67 years later. But I understand it wasn't so easy to seal the deal there, to tie the knot. There was a little roadblock between you and Marie getting married?
That's right. In our state of Louisiana, certainly in New Orleans, you had to be 21 years old to have your parents' consent.
Because you met in the middle in New Orleans.
I was 21, but she was 20. And she had a letter from her mother giving permission for her to get married, but it was not notarized, so that didn't stand up. But we were in the mayor's office over at City Hall to get the license. There was a lady there, a very kind lady, who took us under her wing, and she said, well, let me see what I can do. And she went out in the hall and came back with two policemen, and she said, does this young lady look like she's 21? And they both said yes, and this lady said, well, sign here. And they both said she looked like she was 21 and signed a statement. And then the lady found us a Methodist preacher and said it's time for us to appear at his home. And my wife still gives me a bad time. We took a taxi out to his house. He had the wedding. And then we rode the bus back to the hotel. I tell people our wedding cost us $10, because that's what I gave the preacher. Was bear in mind, this was it. We were just coming out of the Depression.
Yeah, 1943, $10 was a pretty good price.
But I also add the comment, I really think it's been worth $10.
Well, and I guess they were questioning whether she was of sound mind at not 21 yet to make that decision. But I guess if you're still married 67 years later, I guess she was thinking straight.
I think so.
Well, from newly wedded bliss to the reality that sooner or later you're going to head overseas. When did you find out that you're going to be part of the 80th Infantry under Patton's 3rd Army?
I found out right after graduating from OCS that I had been assigned to the 80th Infantry Division. Of course, it was a division that was still in training and hadn't been assigned to anybody's army. And we spent about 3 months out in the desert, Arizona. I was assigned to be the platoon leader of 1st Platoon of Able Company, 317th Regiment, in the 80th Infantry Division.
And what did you understand that to mean as a platoon leader? Did you have a grasp of what that was going to mean for you in a combat zone?
It meant I was going to be responsible for a group of 40 men, and my decisions might affect whether they came out of it well or not. And it's quite a responsibility. But we did some intensive training, and I had a good group of men.
Well, and the way I hear it, that responsibility is something you took very seriously. I'm going to read a letter in a little bit that is going to back that up. But I understand that before you ever went overseas, and you wouldn't go over till September of 44, of course, everybody knows what happened on June 6th, 1944. And even though you were in New Jersey at the time, you were made aware of what was going on. What do you remember about that day?
Well, I remember when the invasion started. We were at Fort Dix, and my wife and I had a room in somebody's home. We were boarding there. I had taken her to New Jersey with me. And all of a sudden, about 4 o'clock in the morning, we heard all the sirens in town go off. and we wondered for a minute what it was, and turned on the radio and found out that the troops had invaded Europe. We figured we will be there shortly, or that was my opinion anyway.
And it wouldn't be too long, but I guess you had some more training to do before you'd go over, getting to know some different weapons?
We did some more training, and we had to get everybody in the division had to have done certain deeds. For instance, they had to have fired the bazooka.
I understand that was your favorite.
And I had to train all of our company in the use of the bazooka. And to make it realistic, we were in sort of a foxhole right down on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And I fired that thing, fired a demonstration three or four times for a group that would come out. And I got back to the house, to Trenton. My wife said, "What in the world happened to your face?" And I didn't realize it, but that bazooka was a rocket. And as the rocket left, being right down on the fire ground, it kicked a bunch of pebbles into my skin, a bunch of grains of sand.
Mm-hmm.
And I was kind of speckled. I didn't realize it till she asked something about it. And we had to make sure everybody had fired the bazooka. Everybody had fired a rifle grenade, which is a grenade that fits on, you put a blank shell in your rifle, and the grenade fits on the end of the, it'll fire about 40 or 50 yards, and it kicked like a bay mule when you fired it, and make sure that everybody was qualified on the rifle range, all the officers were qualified on the pistol range. And that's what we did mostly in Fort Dix, was get everybody qualified.
So after all that, all the hiking, all the training, everything that's happened since Pearl Harbor Day, it's been nearly 3 years now. Were you itching to go overseas, or did what was going on family-wise make you wish you could have stayed around a little longer?
Well, I really wished I could have stayed around a little longer. But once we got overseas, at age of 21, 22, you know, everybody thinks they're invincible.
Mm-hmm.
All the men do. Anyway, we thought, well, that's not going to happen to me.
Well, I understand your wife shared a little nugget of information with you before you left that weighed on you at least a little bit.
Oh, yeah, I did. I wondered about it.
She told you that you may be expecting?
And the baby was born in January, but I wasn't aware that he'd been born until 2 months later. Mm-hmm. And even then, I didn't know whether it was a boy or a girl. She just referred to it in her letters as the baby. And it was about 2 months later before I found out it was a boy.
Wow.
And that was Gid the Third.
Uh-huh. He's the one who ratted you out to me, and I'm thankful for it. But so I just want to put this in perspective for folks today, because we live in such a different world today. And fortunately, those men and women who are courageous enough to volunteer for our armed forces today, and I understand your grandson is one of those, they have a little better means of communication to keep in touch with their family.
Much better, much better.
So here you are. You're shipping off overseas. Not only are you leaving your new wife back in the States, she tells you, oh, yeah, there's a baby on the way. Then once you finally find out she's had the baby, you don't even know if it's a boy or a girl. You got a lot on your mind.
That's right. We had what we call V-mail.
Mm-hmm.
They'd give us a form, and we could write one page on it. And I think they photocopied that, sent it, a whole bunch of them by air back to the States, and then printed them off and sent them to our wives or parents, whoever. That process took 2 or 3 weeks.
And meanwhile, you were kind of busy with what was going on in the European continent.
True. That is very true.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit. You landed at Utah Beach on August the 6th of 44, exactly 2 months after the invasion started.
Right, correct.
What did you see when you got onto French soil? And was it anything that struck you one way or the other?
We landed on the beach in about 3 feet of water. We had to wade ashore.
Mm-hmm.
But on shore, there were some burned out vehicles and a few other indications that there'd been a battle there. And we moved on inland pretty quick. But that night, we could see the anti-aircraft fire going off at the front lines. And so we knew they weren't very far from us. The Allied forces had a bridgehead, and they had one bridge across the I believe it was the Marne River, anyway, across the river. And our orders in England had been to move the division to France and repel the counterattack that they knew was coming. But some other division was already there, and they repelled the counterattack before we got there. But it had surrounded a large number of German soldiers in France. But there was one gap in where they could escape. It was between Argentan and Falaise. They called it the Argentan-Falaise Gap. So our next order was to plug that gap.
Mm-hmm.
That was what we moved into that area. And there was lots of German vehicles burned out. And the Germans had quite a few horse-drawn cannons, stuff like that.
Right.
We saw a multitude of dead horses. I guess because they stood upright, they were more susceptible to shrapnel and things like that. But there was a lot of dead horses, a lot of burned out or abandoned cannon. We were in hedgerow country. The French had plots of ground, maybe 10, 15, maybe 7, 20 acres, that had apparently been that way for years.
Mm-hmm.
And there was an inch hedge around them, a pretty good mound of dirt where the erosion had dropped it, and then a dense hedge on top of the mound. And my platoon sergeant named Johnny Fabrizio, he and I were laying in the hedgerow, although we couldn't see them. We knew about where they were. And a tank pulled up between us, beside us, I mean. And immediately the Germans had cut loose with a machine gun, and we could hear the bullet bouncing off of that tank. And I said, Johnny, if you just got to fight a war, that might be the way to go. But about that time, they hit the tank right below the turret, right where it joined onto the body.
Mm-hmm.
And it lifted that whole tank, whole turret, gun and all, off the back end, along with the top half of the tank commander. And I told Johnny, I said, nope, I'm going to stay on the ground where I get low.
That was an eye-opener.
But we moved on, and we came to an ammunition dump. It was just out in the open, and a lot of ammunition. And about the time we got there, a German tank came down the road and turned a corner just at the edge of that ammunition dump. Of course, they were spraying some machine gun bullets, and we all hit the ground. And I looked up, and I was right beside a great big 8-inch shell. And I thought, boy, if they hit that thing, I'm long gone. But they didn't. They went down the road piece and turned around and came back and turned the corner and went back to where they had come. And so we moved on. And a little while here came, well, I'll take it back. When they came by the first time and turned the corner, I hit them with a bazooka shell. I was trying to hit the track to make them immobile. But it went right above it. And they didn't bother, it didn't faze them. But when they came back, we'd moved on. As they were coming by, I told a sergeant, you had a rifle grenade. I said, let them get by and then hit them in the rear end, because that's where they had the thinnest armor.
Exactly.
And sure enough, he did, and it set them on fire. And the Germans come bailing out.
So you captured the occupants of that tank.
During that time, we had a guy, I think his name was Elmer Roberts, I'm not sure. Small red-haired guy. And when Ned started shooting machine gun bullets at us, he saw an artillery crater, pretty deep crater. And he went running over there and jumped into that. And there were 7 German soldiers in there. And he said they must have figured he was a one-man army, because they all threw their rifles down and threw up their hands and said, Comrade. And he told me later, said, I started to do the same thing, but I recovered my wits. So he took 7 Germans prisoner.
But if he had acted faster, he would have surrendered to them.
And that, I don't recall just what else we did.
But was that?
I do recall
that
we were in a firefight with them later on. Most of the German resistance in France had collapsed. And, of course, there were numerous French villages. And in some of those, they would leave a small group of German soldiers as a delaying action. We mounted on trucks, and one company would go in. If they were the lead company, when they got to the town, they would dismount and go in and secure the town.
Mm-hmm.
Then the rest of the battalion would drive through, and A Company would bring up the rear. We just kind of played leapfrog going across France until we got to the Moselle River. And there we met very, very stiff resistance. We tried to cross it. Part of the battalion got run back. There was a river and a canal, a dry canal, on our side. Had concrete floor and concrete walls. And the concrete walls were about 3 feet below the top of them, about 3 feet below the surface. And we dug in during it. And I remember one afternoon, I had found a K-ration. It had bacon and eggs in it. That was my favorite. Somebody had a little gasoline burner. And I had even heated up some water, made an instant coffee, and opened up my eggs and bacon. When just fixing to eat, and the Germans lopped the shell in, hit the opposite wall of that canal right across from me. Of course, I ducked when I heard the shell coming. You could hear an artillery shell for maybe 2 or 3 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
What got to you? Since it was spiraling, it would whine. Anyway, I ducked. All of a sudden, this big cloud of black powder smoke settled down over my ham and eggs. And that's about the maddest I ever got at the German soldiers. Although I shot at them a good many times, and they shot at me. But I wasn't particularly mad till that happened.
So, I
also, shrapnel put a hole in my canteen cup right sitting up on top of the ground where my head had been. So I figured I was pretty lucky.
I'm pretty sure our listeners would agree with that, and I think I can say they ain't heard nothing yet. We're going to pause right there and then come back with even closer calls that Gid Atkinson experienced as he led his infantry platoon in Europe during World War II. We'll even hear why one of the men who served under him says Gid Atkinson saved that man's life by risking his own. This is Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Let's go back to France in late 1944 now with today's guest, Gid Atkinson Jr. of Abernathy, Texas, served with the 80th Infantry Division in World War II.
But we pulled back about a mile on the side of a steep, very steep hill and got ready to launch a major attack to cross the river and take a hill that was over on the other side of the river. Ordinarily, a regiment had one battalion of artillery in support, but we had 9 battalions of artillery, and we'd gotten 40 heavy machine guns from engineers set up right above us, right above where I was. And the next morning at 4 o'clock, some lone machine gunner fired a short burst and paused, and then all hell broke loose. All the 40 machine guns started firing. Artillery started firing. And it wasn't too long till the Germans figured out where we were, and they started firing back. We made it across the canal and across the river. I went across. My group found a couple of pontoon boats. And we had a man in each, 2 men in the front and 2 in the back, rowing. And they dropped an mortar shell about 20 feet behind us. And you talk about making a dash for the shore. That old boat skimmed up faster than it'd ever been before. And we got ashore. And the whole company, I guess most of the battalion, got ashore. And we took the hill. But he's had a little knob ran out about 1 o'clock in the direction. And the Germans still had that. And we sat there a day or two and got orders to take that knob. Charlie Company in our battalion tried it one day and got run back. The next day, Baker Company tried it. They got run back. And then suddenly, September the 17th, it was Able Company's turn.
Mm-hmm.
And the company commander said, we're going to go in with 2 platoons abreast, spread out abreast, into that woods where the knob, that was on the knob. And he told me, he said, you delay about 5 minutes after we go into the brush, and then you come along the left side to make sure they don't circle around and get behind us. And, okay, we started off, and we heard the nearest battle going on you ever saw. You ever heard hooping and hollering and shooting. But we moved forward until I got to the point where I believe we're beyond where I heard all that noise. So So I got all my troops on the ground, because on the ground you don't make as good a target as you do standing up.
Right.
And I started back kind of to the right rear hunting the rest of the company. I thought we'd run past them. And I met two guys that were hysterical. They said all the company had been killed or captured but us. And I didn't particularly buy that. But at that time, I heard one of my men holler, "Here they come." And I whirled around, and there were a group of German soldiers. And I had a submachine gun, and I cut loose on them. And they all hit the ground. I don't know whether I hit anybody or not. Hope not. But there was one guy out ahead, kind of. And I was standing up. He and I were got about 10 or 15 yards from one another. Hit the ground, raised up, and aimed at one another. And my submachine gun jammed. And I thought, man, that's the end of the line. But I realized there was a little nose of dirt behind me. And I rolled over and over and got behind that. And for some reason or other, he didn't shoot. I guess the good Lord was just looking after me.
I guess so.
But anyway, we had quite a battle there on what we call, later we called it Bloody Knob. The bodies were so thick, German and American, you could nearly walk on them. That night, the Germans withdrew, and the company commander had been wounded, along with another man. They took them prisoners and went down into a little village about half a mile or so in front of us. A day later, here came a couple with a stick and a white flag on it coming up the hill toward us, and it was this company commander and the other guy. Incidentally, the company commander said, "The German medics came out and patched me up while the bullets were still flying." So I guess it was a German medic who thought anybody who's hurt needs our care.
Oh, I'm sure that company commander was very thankful for that.
Our casualty rate was about 39%, if I figured correctly.
Your casualty rate was 39%.
When we went into the battle, and we had, I believe, 149 men and 5 officers. And that night, we could account for 89 men and 3 officers.
I want to read something about that time at Bloody Knob. This was an account by one of the men in your platoon, Justin Baca.
Yeah.
And so you guys are outnumbered. You thought it was a small outpost of Germans. It's actually a full complement of their combat soldiers. And as Justin Baca recounts, 1st Platoon, led by Lieutenant Gidby Atkinson, was directed to attack the enemy from the rear flank. The pressure from the frontal assault, plus the added force from the flank, was so intense that the enemy decided to reposition to the rear. In very short order, our adversaries were attempting to break through us, the 1st Platoon, by firing with precision and effectiveness in a running, continuous attack. The scene was one of flurried activity and fear. There was rapid firing, constant pressure, and heavy casualties on both sides. Platoon leader Atkinson quickly assessed the futility of the situation and the danger to his troops, and he elected to cease the offensive and pull back. Word was passed from soldier to soldier, and most of what remained of the 1st Platoon to reassemble away from attack position. Lieutenant Gidd became aware that an M1 rifle was still firing continuously and rapidly from the most anterior position that the platoon had reached. He voiced a query, "Who is that firing up there?" Sergeant Joe answered, "I'm not sure, but I think it's Baca." Now, most commanders and most leaders would react to the situation as they had learned at officers' training school, to have a non-com carry out the assignment. That is, to alert the infantry soldier above to the change in orders. Baca had not received the order to pull back because the chain of communication was broken. Two of his buddies on his left and several to the right had been fatally wounded. Upon realizing that one of his men was in mortal danger, Lieutenant Atkinson spun around and went back to where his rifleman was. Upon reaching a position abreast of Baca, a sudden surge of German soldiers topped the rise, firing perilously. Lieutenant Atkinson and Baca returned the fire, round for round. In the very thick of this battle, the lieutenant's rifle jammed. In a brief lull, Baca glanced up to see who was next to him and saw that it was his lieutenant. Lieutenant Gidd glanced down at his useless weapon in disbelief, then up at the oncoming horde and threw his rifle to the ground. He then picked up an enemy submachine gun that was lying in front of him. Standing, he and Baca threw out a fusillade of fire that temporarily caused the enemy to fall back. In the brief interlude, the platoon leader bellowed, "We're pulling back. Let's get out of here." "This brave action," Mr. Baca says, "saved my life." Lieutenant Gidd Atkinson moved far above and beyond the call of duty. This is only one episode of many in which this man risked his life to save and keep safe his men. Now, when you hear that, when you realize that one of the men under you felt that way about the way you led that platoon, what does it mean to you?
It means a very great deal. It just moved me to tears to realize that somebody thought that of me. I did what I thought needed to be done. I wasn't trying to be a hero. I just, something needed to be done, I was trying to do it. It really, really moves me when I hear something like that.
And you've heard that from him in person. I understand you met up with him 50 years later at a reunion?
Correct.
And what did he say to you?
About what you told me.
He said, thanks for saving my life.
Right.
There's not a whole lot better things people can say to you than that, are there?
No, that's right.
And obviously, you put yourself in great danger in that situation to save the life of another man. You were in danger quite a bit. You were wounded 3 different times?
That's right. I've got Purple Heart and 1 oak leaf cluster, but I was wounded later on a mission. But I'd lost a lot of men in that battle, and I had a minor wound, slash across the leg, and I didn't have the gall to take a Purple Heart when I'd had a bunch of men killed. So I just got credit for 2 wounds, although I was wounded 3 times.
That makes sense. What was the most serious wound or the most scary situation where you were hurt, where you felt like it could have been worse than it was?
Well, the first time I was wounded, we were out on a patrol in some woods and underbrush, and I was leading the patrol, and I spotted a German soldier. I don't know what he was doing out there by himself. But about that time, he spotted me, and we both knew, hit the ground and both knew about where the other one was, and we were just firing and gradually coming around. I had an M1 rifle, but he had a submachine gun. He could fire faster than I could anyway. I got shot through the left knee, and that was quite painful. They sent me back to the division clearing station, and the doctor looked at me and said, you just got a flesh wound. You'll be all right in a day or two. But my leg swelled up to about twice its normal size.
Oof.
So they decided to ship me back to Field Hospital, which is just a big circus-type tent. I was on a stretcher on top of a cot, and I laid there for 2-3 days. Well, first, when I got there, they x-rayed my leg and said, you've got a little sliver off the jacket of a bullet in your knee. And the hospital commander said, I'm not going to put you to sleep. I'm just going to deaden it locally and take that out. And there was a nurse. This stretcher was laying up on the table. And a nurse was holding both wrists with an elbow across my chest. And that doctor went in there, and he hit a nerve that wasn't dead. And I nearly came unbuckled. The nurse said, open your mouth. And when I did, she crammed a doubled-up blanket in it. Said, now maybe you won't break any teeth. And that doctor said, was that touchy? And doggone if he didn't do it again.
In this case,
they shipped me back to hospital in Paris, France. And when I went in, I had a front tooth broken out sometime. I don't know when. I guess I swallowed it. But I hadn't shaved since I'd been wounded. Incidentally, in General Patton's army, you shaved every day.
Mm-hmm.
But since I'd been in the hospital, I didn't have an opportunity. And the nurse took one look at me and just died laughing. Said, you're the sorriest-looking piece of humanity I ever saw. So she fixed me a bath and a box to sit on in a bathtub where I wouldn't get my knee wet. And a doctor who had the rank of captain came in, and he looked at my leg a little bit. He went back, he got a pair of crutches. He said, now you get up and walk all you can. And put all the weight you can on that leg. Well, that leg had got to where I couldn't straighten it out. It lacked about 10 degrees being straight. Fortunately, the head doctor of the U.S. Army, the Surgeon General, he had the rank of Major General, came by my room, and he picked up the chart on the end of the bed and said, compound comminuted fracture. He raised up the cover, and he said, Lieutenant, where's your cast? It's like I'd pulled it off and thrown it away. I said, sir, I've never had one. He threw that chart down and took off out of the hot room. And about 2 minutes, here came the hospital commander, who was a colonel. And he did the same thing. He looked at the chart, looked at the leg, threw it down, and took off. And a few minutes here came this captain. He looked at my chart again. He grabbed those crutches and said, "Don't get out of that bed." A little while here came a corporal. I said, "Corporal, what's going on?" He said, he grinned and said, "You're going to get a cast right now." And sure enough, one was a few minutes till they came and got me and put me a cast full length from all the way up from my hip down to the ankle. And I wore that thing for 2 months, I guess. But they shipped me on back to England, and I was in the hospital there.
Right, so you spent about 3 months recuperating, but then would end up back on the lines. I'm curious about that time where you were out of commission. How did you spend your time? What was on your mind? Were you able to trade letters with your wife at all at that point? Did she know what you were going through? Did you get some moral support from her? How did that work?
No. Bail was so slow, and I didn't want her to worry. And I had written her and told her I was wounded, but not to worry about me. I was in a safe place. See, we weren't allowed to say where we were.
Right. They'd censor it anyway.
But as far as what we did, we played cards and talked about what we were going to do when we got out of service, just general visiting. I was on a 25-bed ward and had good nursing care.
We're getting a little short on time here, and I do want to ask you about the incident for which you earned the Bronze Star. In reading through some of the stuff that your son has helped you put together about your story, I found so many instances that I think people would be impressed with the courage, the bravery that you displayed, sometimes picking up other soldiers, carrying them to safety. Tell me about this incident that you earned the Bronze Star for, because you'd already been wounded off the lines, and now you're back in action, back in combat.
This was in, I guess, the first part of March. I'm not sure.
1945.
At that time, I had been promoted to company commander.
Mm-hmm.
And got orders to take a hill. We had to go down a long, sloping hill and up a fairly steep hill in order to get it. We got down about two-thirds of the way down that hill, and they rolled a couple of tanks out of the woods up on top of the hill we were supposed to take and cut loose, which wasn't too bad, except we didn't have any place to, any cover, to get anything to get behind. And about that time, they started firing at us from our right front. So we were caught in a crossfire. And I had to, my radio operator got a bullet through his radio, and he took off. But we still had one we could use. And I had to adjust artillery fire and tell the troops what we were going to do. And finally, it got so bad that I just called back to the battalion headquarters and said, "Lay me a smoke screen in here. I've got to get out. We're getting slaughtered." And they did. I tried to evacuate some wounded and got shot at a few times. But that's when I got the Bronze Star, was directing people to. It said, the citation says, take the objective. You couldn't get a citation if you said you were retreating. So it read, take the objective. We didn't take it. But we did get shot all to pieces.
And you survived it and helped some others.
I stepped there to help some people and to adjust artillery fire.
You received that Bronze Star, but a house fire in 1966, you lost all your medals, and you hadn't worried about it for a long time. And just now, in the last couple months, you got your medals again?
We were just really shocked. We had been told by a local banker, of course, we lived near Aberdash, which is real small. Local banker told us we were going to have a little reception for one of the retired teachers, who's a real close friend of ours. And we walked in, and about that time, our kids, four or five of our kids walked in, and we were just floored. And I had no idea that he'd gotten the medals.
Well, and I imagine it's kind of like what you described earlier when I read Baca's account of how you saved his life, that when you have your children conspiring to do something for you this way, to surprise you, to get back something that you would have never fought to get back, but was important to them to have you possess those again, that probably meant a lot to you and said a lot about what an important figure you've been.
It really did.
I want to ask you, too, before we run out of time here, and I know there's a lot that we can't fit in here, and when this book gets published of your story, then I hope everybody will take the time to read it and read even more about your exploits in the Army during World War II. When you actually got to come home, here you've been wounded, taken off the lines multiple times, each time going back into combat, back into harm's way, back into positions where your wife could be left a widow and that baby that you still don't know anything about would be left fatherless. When you actually got to come back home to America, see your bride again, meet your son for the first time, how can you put that into words for us? How can you describe that experience?
I had her address. She lived in Lubbock, Texas. I had her address, and I went up and knocked on the door, and some lady came to the door, and she said, no, she has moved. Oops. But she gave me their new address, and I started over there, and I got about a block away, and I turned around, and I went back. I said, would you tell me what that address is again? I was so excited that it didn't register with me. And then when I met my wife, she wasn't expecting me that quick, but she met me at the door in a house coat and all her hair all up in rollers. But it was a joyous reunion.
I'm sure she looked like she was ready for the red carpet to you. She probably couldn't have looked any better.
Right, she did.
And to look into the eyes of a son you'd never met before?
He was with his maternal grandparents who lived over another town about 90 miles away. So it was 2 or 3 days before I got to see him.
What was that like for you? Because and so many of our listeners are parents, and we know as parents how much we care about our children, how much it means to see a little piece of us in that next generation and hope to instill what we want to in them. And here you've been half a world away fighting for the freedom that you hope he's going to get to enjoy, but you've never seen his face before. You never met him before. What was that moment like for you?
I thought he was the cutest kid I ever saw.
I'm sure you still tell him that today, right?
He was nearly a year old at that time.
Right. And I don't want to get all sentimental or mushy here, but In a moment like that, does it occur to you, this is what I was fighting for, that for him and whatever future children and grandchildren I have, for them to have a free country and a free world, that this is what I was fighting for?
That's right.
And you went on to have 6 children, right?
Correct.
So 5 of them would have never been born if you didn't make it home.
That is correct.
And I'm sure you got grandkids and great-grandkids you can say the same thing for.
I have 13 grandkids and 4 great-grandkids.
So that's a lot of people who never would have been born if you didn't make it home from the war, if you hadn't survived all those situations, absorbed all those wounds, and made it home. When you think about that, when you think about the fact that you made it home and more than 400,000 Americans didn't make it home, what does that mean to you? Why do you think that is? Why do you think you got to come home?
I'm not a preacher. I don't go around preaching. But I think God was looking after me. I think he had something he wanted me to do.
I don't think anybody's going to argue with you. And I know you've been a pretty busy man since then. You went into teaching, were even the superintendent of schools there.
Yes.
Well, when you think back about it now, when you think about all the time that you spent in combat and in an infantry platoon, no less, this is where the most intense action occurs. You saw guys around you die. You came close to being killed yourself. When you think back on it now and you think of all those kids and grandkids, what do you want them to know about you, the guys you served with, and what you were all up to in World War II?
Well, I guess I really want them to know we were fighting for a way of life that we enjoy in the United States. Not every country in the world enjoys that freedom.
And you saw firsthand that freedom doesn't come cheap, huh?
It doesn't come cheap. Oh, incidentally, I might close out with this. The last time I was wounded was a mortar shell hit on the road right beside me, pretty close. And I got a piece of shrapnel in my leg and my arm. But a shell had hit ahead of us. And, of course, if you're down on the ground, you're less apt to get shrapnel. And I was in the process of falling when the one that went off beside me. It put a hole in the zipper of my jacket right under my throat. Missed my throat by about 2 inches. And there were 14 holes in the back of my jacket. So you think somebody wasn't looking after me? I believe it.
I believe it, too, and I think everybody listening does. Mr. Atkinson, I just want to say thank you for serving our country. Thank you for telling us a little bit about it. And it sounds like you got plenty of vim and vigor and vitality, and you're ready to do a few more things here in the next few years.
Well, I hope so. I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you.
Well, I appreciate you doing it. The privilege, the pleasure is all mine. And one of these days, maybe I'll get to shake your hand somewhere.
Okay, hope so.
All right. That's Gid Atkinson, 88 years old. He'll be 89 next month. Joining us today from Abernathy, Texas. We'll be back next week with another edition of Hometown Heroes here on News Talk 580 KMJ.